From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The secret word is back, and it's good. On today's Fresh Air, a trip through Pee-wee's Playhouse with its creator, Paul Reubens. All 45 episodes of the series will be airing on the Cartoon Network starting next month. The Playhouse was broadcast Saturday mornings from 1986 to 91 and won 22 Emmys. We'll talk with Reubens about creating Pee-wee. Also, now that Superman has returned, we'll look back at the original Superman TV series with Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen. We'll remember TV mogul Aaron Spelling, and David Edelstein reviews the film The Devil Wears Prada. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Pee-wee's Playhouse, all five seasons, that's 45 episodes, is becoming the children's TV show that refuses to die. It was broadcast as a CBS Saturday morning kids show from 1986 to 1991, but its audience included a lot of adults, myself included, who loved the humor, the characters, and the design. Our guest, Paul Reubens, starred as Pee-wee, an endlessly enthusiastic kid in an adult's body. He played the character on the CBS series and in two big-screen movies, the first of which, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, was a big hit directed by Tim Burton. Yet after the series ended, Paul Reubens was arrested on charges of indecent exposure at a Florida adult movie theater, and both Reubens and Pee-wee basically vanished. But Pee-wee, after a period of dormancy, is enjoying a new life. 2 years ago, the entire Pee-wee's Playhouse series was released on DVD and sold very well. Starting July 10th, Cartoon Network will begin showing old Playhouse episodes in its late-night Adult Swim showcase, the home of such ultra-hip fare as The Boondocks, Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, and Robot Chicken. Also next month, a film of the live stage show that started it all, the impish The Pee-wee Herman Show that's now 25 years old, will be released on DVD. Terry talked with Paul Reubens in 2004 about creating his alter ego, Pee-wee Herman. He would not, however, talk about his past legal problems or his collection of erotica. Pee-wee's Playhouse, the Saturday morning show on CBS, had a great cast of characters. Even the inanimate objects were alive. The chair, the window, and the daisies on the windowsill could all talk. A puppet band of beatnik-style hipsters played jazz, sang, and talked in rhymes. The food in the refrigerator was alive. And in each episode, a robot-like boombox named Conky printed out a secret word.
Ready to assist you, Pee-wee.
Morning, Conky.
What's today's secret word?
Today's secret word is
good.
Now, you all know what to do whenever anybody says a secret word, right?
That's right.
The rest of the day, if anybody says a secret word,
scream real loud. Ready? Let's try it. Hi, guys, what are you doing?
Cool cats pounding out the beat.
And we're standing with our feet.
Like they're dancing, man.
I can dig it. Hey, let me try rhyming.
Cool.
I'd talk like you do if I could.
Come on, Pee-wee, you're doing good.
A great big scream is what we heard.
I must have said the secret word.
This rhyming's fun, I agree, but now it's time to play with me.
Hey, Magic Screen, that was really good.
Let's listen to Terry's interview with Paul Reubens, recorded in 2004. I think it's pretty good.
So let's start at the very beginning of the birth of Pee-wee Herman. How did you first create the character? I think this was back in the Groundlings era when you were working with that improv comedy group.
Yeah, it was, I believe, 1977. I was three, and we were doing a night where we were kind of doing an extended scene, what we called an extended scene, and we were trying to do something where it was like a comedy club, like the Comedy Store or the Improv. We were all supposed to be different characters that you might see in a comedy club. So I decided to be the guy at the comedy club that everybody would like immediately know this guy was never going to make it as a comic. And part of it was because I couldn't remember jokes in real life. I couldn't remember the punchline, or I'd get halfway through the joke, and I was always the guy who'd be like, oh, wait, no, I forgot to tell you this part, you know? So that's, and that character just sort of came out that night. I mean, I borrowed a suit from the director of the Groundlings, Gary Austin. I borrowed his suit, which had been made for him by a guy named Mr. J, if he's out there listening. And, somebody else gave me a little tiny bow tie. I had a little 1-inch long harmonica that said Pee-wee on it. And I knew a kid whose last name was Herman. And Pee-wee Herman sounded like the kind of name you would never make up. It sounded like, you know, a totally real name, like made by somebody whose parents were, you know, didn't really care about them.
So, well, let's talk about the creation of the Saturday morning version of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay.
Let's start with your voice, since you're speaking to us on the radio. Obviously, you didn't use your regular voice for the character of Pee-wee. How did you arrive at that kind of high and laughy voice that you created?
You know, I had been doing, years before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, I worked at a theater that was the State Theater of Florida called the Oslo Theater, which is still in existence, still a fantastic place, which was in my hometown, Sarasota, Florida, and was based at the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art, which Sarasota, as you may or may not know, was the former headquarters of the winter headquarters of the Ringling Brothers Circus, so there's a lot of Ringling influence there. And I had... been doing Life with Father in repertory with a bunch of other shows. And my character, I was the second oldest son, not the star son, but the second banana son. And over a 3-month period, and I'm not bragging about this, this probably wasn't a good thing, but my character developed into this total cartoon character. And I didn't really even realize it, but you know, 3 months down the line, somebody said, wow, do you remember what you were originally doing and what you're doing now? And I was like, wow, it is really different. So the voice came from that. That is Pee-wee's voice. It was from, you know, good morning, mother, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that became Pee-wee's voice.
So
I love that story.
So from doing theater, you developed the voice for Pee-wee?
Yep. You sound incredulous.
Well, it sounds like it must have been pretty cartoony by the time it was done.
It was. It was pretty cartoony.
How did that happen? Did you not like the play?
You know, I don't know. No, I loved the play. I thought it was a really great play. I think I just wasn't very professional. I was an idiot. I didn't know you weren't supposed to, like, change it completely into a cartoon. It was unwitting. Unwittingly? I did it unwittingly, Jerry.
Can we talk a little bit about the look of Pee-wee's Playhouse? It was just such a fantastic set of images, you know, bright colors, all kinds of like shapes, and everything was alive in it. You know, like the chair had arms that could embrace the person sitting in it, and the chair talked, and the window talked. How was the look designed, and were you a part of that?
Were you taking some kind of psychedelic drug when you watched that show? No, I'm just kidding, Terry. The look of the show really had a lot to do with an artist named Gary Panter, who designed the original stage version of it and designed much of the... was really the overall production designer and created the look of the show. The television version of it. He was somebody who, when I was really creating that character in the early days of Pee-wee Herman, was kind of like the punk scene in Los Angeles. And he was kind of one of the premier, like, punk artists. And I had seen a lot of his work. He was in a publication called the LA Weekly.
And in Raw Magazine that Art Spiegelman edited.
Exactly. And I'd seen a lot of his work, and I loved his work. And I contacted him and asked him if he would do a poster for a show that I hadn't created yet. And he said, well, why don't I do the poster? And well, actually, he said, let me come down and see what it is. So he came down and saw me in the Groundlings show, where I had my little 10-minute Pee-wee thing, and came backstage and said, I'd love to do it, but why don't I do the whole thing? Why don't I design the sets and the puppets and everything? And I said, yeah, great. So he designed that, and then when we... got the deal with CBS a few years later to do it as a real television series, he came on board. He was the first person I hired and said, you know, you gotta do this set. So it was, the rest is history, I guess. But, I think it's probably the most amazing aspect of the show, in my opinion, is the design of it. It was just so startlingly incredible, in my opinion.
Now, you've said that one of the things you really loved about the character of Pee-wee Herman was that he showed that it was okay to be different. What did you feel was most different about you when you were growing up?
You know, I guess I felt like a total oddball all the, like almost every minute of growing up, so it'd be hard to kind of isolate that. But, I mean, I think that sort of was the whole point of the show, or at least a big point of the show, was that, like, you know, it would be hard to stand out in the Playhouse, you know? Like, everything stood out in the Playhouse. So you could sort of feel real right at home no matter who you are or what you were thinking or anything.
Paul Rubens, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Paul Rubens. He's the creator and star of Pee-wee's Playhouse, which is about to return in reruns on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim.
Tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like, where you grew up, and what your school years were like. Were you uncomfortable in school? Did you do well in school? Were you picked on?
Well, I grew up in an orphanage, and...
Oh, stop.
Oh, no, that was my... fantasy character, sorry. I grew up in upstate New York, Oneonta, New York, until we moved in between third and fourth grade. We moved, which was like a huge relief to me because Mrs. Lake that I had in third grade was really mean to me and scared the hell out of me as far as math goes. Like, I still to this day, if I got to add or subtract anything, I almost go into a coma. So we moved. So I had an incredible upbringing in upstate New York, which included the New York State Teachers College is in Oneonta, and there was a laboratory school that my sister and I went to, and we lived in a really small town where there was lots of nature and animals, and we had a little creek with a crab apple tree across the street. I'm going to burst into tears in a second. it was really like a very storybook kind of upbringing. And then we moved to Florida. And moving to Florida was like incredible. I thought we moved to Hawaii. I thought we were in the tropics or something. And my mother took us to go get back to school clothes. And I bought all these beachcomber outfits. So I showed up for the first day of school in fourth grade in Florida with like clam digger pants on and these nautical shirts and like a total freak. And the kids at school were like, what are you supposed to be? And the thing that was funny about it in hindsight is like, normally I'm in that kind of situation. I think the kids would probably, you would probably go like, oh, sorry. You know, I didn't know what it was. But me, I was totally like, don't you get it? You know, I'm a beachcomber. What's wrong with you guys? And instead, like the next day, I like put out another variation of the same outfit and put it on and got back to school and was like, you know, these kids are going to come around or they're not, whatever. But I'm not changing.
Was this your theatrical impulse expressing itself?
I think it was, yeah, at a very early stage.
So when you moved to Sarasota, which you said was the winter headquarters for Ringling Brothers Circus, did you meet any circus people?
Oh, I met lots of circus people. I mean, for one thing, you could see the circus people coming down the street. You know, like the lady with the bright red hair and the wooden shoes, you know, would be obviously a circus person. I mean, you could just tell that they were very show business people in a very small town, a conservative small town. So you could tell who they were. We rented a little house the first year we moved to Sarasota. And we used to hear these explosions all the time. And we never could figure out what they were. And one day, a couple weeks after we moved, our whole family was walking. We took a walk one night after dinner. And we heard this explosion. And we looked in between these two homes. We saw somebody flying through the air in between these two homes. And it turned out that it was the Zucchini family. And they were the family with the giant silver cannon, and they were shooting each other out of a cannon in the backyard.
That's so bizarre.
And in fact, years later, when I made my circus movie, we went back to Sarasota and recreated that cannon.
For Big Top Pee Wee?
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you love that
Did you want to be in the circus after seeing this?
I did. You know, I actually thought that if... I've been asked, like, what would have happened if you weren't successful as Pee Wee Herman? What would you have done? And I really thought I was headed for a career in the circus.
As
the pinheaded guy. No, the the unfunny guy. The guy who, I don't know, I knew how to walk a tightrope. I could do trapeze.
Could you really walk a tightrope?
Oh, yeah.
How'd you learn that?
I went to circus camp when I was young.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I swear.
And did you ever do the Circus Barker rap?
No, I never did that. I considered briefly covering my body with tattoos, but I didn't do that, which is a good thing now because, you know, everybody has that now,
that's
so
right.
It wouldn't really be, like, you know, it'd be sad if I did that. I did, like, I started out, I had a balance beam act. My parents showed up to circus camp when we were putting on the show, and I had on, like, a little Speedo bathing suit, and I'd get up on the balance beam with a blindfold on and, like, set these, like, rings on fire and do this insane, completely insane act. Like, look, I pulled the blindfold off and looked at my parents. And they were both sitting up in the bleachers with their mouths open, like, what have we created? You know, like, totally. I think that was probably an early tip-off to them that I wasn't going to be an architect.
So were you inhibited or extroverted as a kid?
One or the other?
Or something in between?
You know, honestly, I think I was probably a little of each. I was sort of skitsy when I was like a kid. I would be like very introverted and in, you know, up in my room by myself. And then I would be like the life of the party, you know, like gathering all the kids around to like, we had a little stage in our basement that my dad built me once he realized he was raising a little monster actor. So the kids in the neighborhood would come over and try to figure out, like, what was the teeniest part they could give me so they could use the stage. So we would do, like, these murder mysteries where, like, the opening of the show would be me getting pushed off stage into a vat of acid. And then I would be like... You know, my part would be over, and then all the older kids would, like, do the show. It wasn't until later in life I realized, you know, I'd come in and go, like, you've met my attorney, right? So let's see. You know, talk to them.
What TV shows did you watch as a kid?
You know, I was part of an early study on the effects of television on children when I was going to that school in upstate New York I mentioned. I remember... being in first or second grade and having some scientists come into our class to ask us questions about, like, what shows we liked. And all the rest of the kids were like, Mickey Mouse Club and Howdy Doody. And my favorite show was I Love Lucy. And so I got, like, selected out of the whole class. I had to go in, you know, leave the office, leave the classroom and go to an office. And... Listen to a bunch of scientists like go like, well, what was it about the I Love Lucy show that that attracts you, and who do you like better, Lucy or Desi or Ethel or Fred? And you know, I was like in second grade, I didn't know any. I just thought like, well, I like the show just because I like the show. That's a long way to answer. I didn't even answer your question. I watched in addition to I Love Lucy, when I was really young. I loved the Mickey Mouse Club. I loved Captain Kangaroo, and I loved Howdy Doody. I was even on the Howdy Doody show. My mother drove me and my sister to New York, and we were on the Howdy Doody show.
In the peanut gallery?
Mm-hmm. Somebody knows the Howdy Doody show. Good. Impressive.
What was it like to be inside rather than watching it on the TV?
Very confusing. I remember my sister was so freaked out. She burst into tears right before the show, and she had to be, like, put in an isolation booth. She didn't make it. She didn't make it on the air. But I did. I was like, oh, after this drive, you got to be kidding. Try to axe me from the show. Forget it. I was right up in there. But the thing that was weird about it was, like, you couldn't see Howdy Doody. You couldn't see anything except, like, all the lights and cameras. And, I mean, it was just, it was really weird and kind of semi-disappointing.
Why was it disappointing? Oh, because you couldn't see.
Yeah, just because I didn't realize that there were lights and cameras. And, you know, it's something interesting. Like, from that experience, I now kind of, when I meet little kids, you know, out and about, like, for, like, we did the DVD signing the other day here in Manhattan, and 1,000 fans showed up. And I spoke to lots and lots of people, including some kids who would, you know, be just sort of staring at me. And I know enough now to say, like, I don't look like myself, do I? You know, and I look bigger, don't I? And that kind of stuff. Because, you know, when you're a kid, like, it didn't occur to me that everything was real life size. You know, I thought Buffalo Bob was, like, you know, the size of somebody who could fit inside the TV.
Paul Rubens, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I had a lot of fun.
Paul Rubens, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His 1986 to 1991 TV series, Pee-wee's Playhouse, is about to be repeated in late night on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. It starts July 10th. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
She's the girl on the flying trapeze. She's the sweetest thing that's ever flown in with the breeze. And if you see her, tell her that I'm in love with her. She's the girl on the flying trapeze.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. And from IFC Films and the Weinstein Company, presenting Wordplay, a look inside the crossword puzzle phenomenon with New York Times crossword editor Will Shortz and others. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll talk with Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen in the original Superman TV series. Also, we remember the man who brought us Fantasy Island, Dynasty, and Charlie's Angels. Aaron Spelling died last week at age 83. And we'll tell you why the devil wears Prada. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. TV producer Aaron Spelling, who died last Friday, will forever be remembered for his enormously popular TV shows.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy. And they were each assigned very hazardous duties. But I took them away from all that, and now they work for me. My name is Charlie.
Charlie's Angels is one of the more than 200 shows and movies Aaron Spelling churned out during his career. Our critic at large, John Powers, has these thoughts on why he believes Spelling is important.
although our politicians might find it hard to believe, what the world loves most about the U.S. isn't really our vaulting ideas of freedom. It's the spirit this freedom imparts to our popular culture. Humor, frivolity, the bearable lightness of being. Unseriousness is the American way. By such a standard, one of our great patriots died last week at age 83. I refer to Aaron Spelling, the Prospero of primetime TV, whose life was a quintessentially American story. The Dallas-born son of a Russian immigrant tailor, Spelling made himself into the most successful TV producer of all time by giving people what they wanted, whether they should want it or not. Charlie's Angels, Fantasy Island, Dynasty, Melrose Place. Because his shows were so often silly, even junky, it was easy to underrate his importance. But as absurd as it may sound, Spelling was a worldwide cultural force on the level of Elvis, Spielberg, or Starbucks. Although I don't know anyone who didn't enjoy some Spelling shows, many people tended to feel superior to them. Because we've all been trained to look down on TV, as if Deadwood isn't better than any Hollywood movie now in our theaters, it became easy to overlook the intelligence behind what Spelling memorably termed his mind candy. Although he did churn out countless hours of dreck, he grasped that TV's seductiveness lies in speed, wit, and disposability. He knew how to pull off unlikely alchemies, turning a zip code into a watchword for glamour, transforming pimps into adorable huggy bears, making Kate Jackson world-renowned as the smart one. He put Andy Warhol on the Love Boat, mass-marketed camp in Dynasty, and he set the template for international youth culture by offering a teen's-eye view of life in Beverly Hills 90210. This made him rich, but also a figure of fun. Just as Spelling's work was routinely described as schlock, so the man himself was mocked for parvenu tackiness. As if erecting a monument to his own lack of taste, he built The Manor, a hideous 56,000-square-foot home in West Los Angeles that looks like a McMansion scaled from Mount Olympus, although it's hard to imagine Zeus and Hera insisting on their own private bowling alley. But good taste has never been essential to pop culture brilliance, and it often proves a liability. There's a reason why Charlie's Angels got vastly higher ratings than Masterpiece Theater. Rather than hammer away at supposedly important themes, his shows toyed with the zeitgeist, making hay of 60s rebellion, women's lib, or the contemporary worship of wealth. Shamelessness was part of their allure, and Spelling knew it. Like the Jewish studio moguls of an earlier generation, he started on the outside looking in, and it gave him a killer instinct for what the public likes. And what it likes is what Spelling liked and eventually came to symbolize, all that's gaudy and seductive about Southern California. Sun, skin, money, and just enough safe, non-Manson-level craziness to keep things interesting. As an artistic vision, this may not exactly be Tolstoy, but it's no more childish than May the Force Be With You. And no less potent. Pretty much everyone has been touched, or is that warped, by their own favorite Spelling series. Mine is the first one I ever remember watching, Burke's Law, an early 60s crime romp which, I later learned, was the first of his shows to turn real life into a fantasy island. Gene Barry starred as lady-killing Amos Burke, L.A.'s dapper chief of detectives, who also just happened to be a millionaire, back when that meant you could own a mansion and be chauffeured to crime scenes in your Rolls Royce. As a Midwestern kid, I ate this all up, staying up past my bedtime to revel in the posh settings, cool murders, and naturally, the chicks. Like so many of Spelling's programs, Burke's Law posited a universe stocked with beautiful women whose virtue was as limited as their bodaciousness was infinite. They seemed to enter the room horizontally. Although I eventually learned the hard truth that this was not gritty realism, a small part of me never really outgrew it. Somewhere deep inside, I still expect that one day a busty socialite will start purring amorously simply because I've walked through the door. Well, of course you do, I can hear Spelling chuckle from the 90210 of the great beyond. We are such stuff as adolescent dreams are made on. How do you think I got that mansion?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, a chat with TV's original Jimmy Olsen. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie Superman Returns, Jack Larson makes a small appearance as a character named Bo the Bartender. To teenagers coming to the Superman franchise for the first time, that may not mean much. But for those of us of a certain age, the appearance by Larson is a delightful inside joke. That's because before Larson became a librettist, a playwright, a poet, and a movie producer, he spent most of the 1950s playing Jimmy Olsen in the TV series Adventures of Superman. Here's a clip from one of those episodes. Jimmy Olsen is at the office with Clark Kent and Lois Lane. He's showing off a new invention he's just bought, a portable typewriter.
Pretty nifty, isn't it, Mr. Kent? I can almost carry it in my pocket. Now, if I have any special outside assignments, I can carry my typewriter with me.
That's right, Jimmy. It looks like a good practical investment to me.
There it is. Eyewitness report of a burglary that didn't burgle too well.
Well, congratulations, Lois.
Gee, that's cute.
Cute? Can't you think of some other word to call it, Miss Lane? I don't want to be known as the boy with the cute typewriter.
I'm afraid it's hopeless, Jimmy. I once knew a woman who referred to the Grand Canyon as cute.
Well, whatever you call it, I didn't know the chief was handing out raises.
Oh, I didn't get a raise.
Then I didn't know he was handing out rich uncles.
In a way, I guess you could say an uncle had something to do with it. Uncle Sam. When I was in school, I used to buy Treasury savings stamps every week. By the time I graduated, they turned into bonds.
So you cashed in the bonds on this typewriter?
Only part of them. You see, the interest I got on my investment made the bonds worth a lot more than what I put into them.
Well, that's very interesting, Jimmy. And speaking of learning to save, that ties in exactly with something I heard last night.
And when did you hear anything about saving last night, Mr. Kent? I was with you all the time, remember?
Oh, yes, Lois. Well, this must have been some other evening when you weren't with me.
The syndicated Superman series, which ran from 1953 to 1959, also starred George Reeves as Superman and Noel Neal as Lois Lane. Noel Neal also makes an appearance in Superman Returns, playing a character named Gertrude Vanderworth. Jack Larson's acting career started before TV's Superman, when he was a contract actor for Warner Brothers. He gave up acting shortly after Superman because he thought typecasting was preventing him from landing good roles. Terry spoke with Jack Larson in 1993.
How did you get the role as Jimmy Olsen on Superman?
Times weren't easy with the demise of the Hollywood contract system, and I got a part in a play, and that play was supposed to get to New York. We didn't get to New York, but we played very glamorously in Los Angeles, and at that point, I was offered another stock contract at 20th Century Fox in a part in a film, and I didn't want another stock contract at a studio. By that time, I wanted to go to Broadway, New York, here I come, and I didn't have any money. You know, you got equity minimum for doing a play. And I was offered the Superman television show, which was one of the first shows ever filmed. Nobody knew what it was. There had been no film television, only live television. And so I was hesitant to do it. And the people that wanted me very much said, look, it's like doing a Saturday morning serial. You know, for theater serials. No one will ever see it. You're a very difficult kid. You don't want another stock contract. You don't want this. You don't want that. You want to get to New York? Well, take the money and run and do this. So I signed on to play Jimmy Olsen in Superman. It didn't go on the air for 2 years. We shot that in the summer of 1951, summer and fall. And I was in New York working in live television when Superman went on the air, and it became instantly very popular, and my character became popular, and I became Jimmy Olsen.
Well, you were interested in writing, in serious acting, and here you were on Superman playing this golly gee whiz naive cub reporter. It sounds like you were really nothing like the character you were playing. Did you enjoy playing that kind of role? Did it get annoying after a while?
I loved playing Jimmy. And I now, all these years later, regard it as a fulfillment of myself as an actor. I think Jimmy was, it was my part. Being a pioneer in television like that, in film television, they were so busy technically learning how to film a show quickly that they let us all alone as performers, and they let me create Jimmy, and I had a wonderful time doing it, and worked with first-rate character actors, people like George E. Stone, Sterling Holloway, Elizabeth Patterson, and you learn from these people who were major actors from the theater and in films, and I wanted to do comedy and comedy bits, and they'd let me alone. And once I became popular, they really let me alone to just do what I wanted to do. So you were like a pioneer in the early days of silent films, a two-reel comedy, doing television.
How many times were you kidnapped as Jimmy Olsen?
Oh, I don't know, probably every third show I was kidnapped as Jimmy and had a bomb. If I was ever kidnapped, I was either tied to a chair with a bomb at my feet or sealed in a room somewhere that Superman couldn't see through because there was mysterious lead in the brick or something. But that never bothered me. What bothered me was the writers and the producers they liked to have Jimmy nearly drown. And they used to like to get me wet, like put me in a cave, and the tide is coming in the cave, and the cave has bars, and Jimmy is going to be drowned. This was a holdover, I guess, from the old Saturday morning serials, as I said. And the problem with that, I never mind being wet. I will do anything as an actor, but you get sick. Because once they get you wet, if you've got work to do afterwards, you stay wet. And the next day work, if you're rescued, for instance, Superman would come in and rescue, tear back the bars of the cave and carry Jimmy out, who would say, "Golly, Superman, I never thought you'd get here in time. I thought I was a goner for sure." And I'd be carried outside dripping wet. Well, your next scenes, all your next work, the resolution, you're still wet. They come with a hose and wet you down. And I would always catch a cold. Sound stages are cold. And it drove me crazy. And they never cared. And I finally told them, it was about the second season and my 10th wet show. And I said, "Listen, I don't want to seem a spoil sport, but I don't like working sick. And I catch a cold in these cold sound stages. So quit. You can regard me from now on as a dry actor."
Years ago, it was like the first year I was in radio, it was in the mid-70s, I think. I interviewed Noelle Neal, your co-star. She was...
Oh, did you?
She was Lois Lane.
Yes, she's a darling person.
Well, one of the questions I asked her was this. I said, "I remember all these episodes where you were kidnapped and you were tied up and you were wriggling around while you were, you know, in bondage. And so, you know, sometimes you'd be dressed in the chiffon robe and you were supposed to be sacrificed until Superman came and rescued you." And I said,
"Right.
You know, did you ever think about the kind of S&M type of imagery that was?" And she said, "We never thought about those kinds of things."
No.
Did you really never think about those kinds of things?
No, I really didn't. I know the show you're referring to where the a ancient cult kidnapped both of us in a tomb and they stripped me. I'm in like a jock strap or something, little thing, and she's in a beautiful filmy thing and we're tied to pillars or something and they're going to kill us. And I guess it was wild S&M. I don't know. No, I never thought about it. We were too busy working. We never thought about a lot of things, you know. I always played the Jimmy, dumb enough. I felt that Jimmy was so dumb that he couldn't tell Superman was Clark Kent because Clark Kent wore a pair of horn-rimmed glasses.
Right, right.
And I thought, if you're that unaware, and any kind of a thing. Once actually Clark Kent, there's one show where Jimmy's beside him and Clark Kent has fallen through his shower door and he's in bed and Jimmy seems to be sharing the apartment at that time or something. He's taking care of him and Clark Kent does not have on his glasses and Jimmy doesn't even still recognize him as Superman. And I pointed it out to the director and the producer. I said, "Well, now, you know, here we are and he doesn't have on these glasses because he's fallen through his shower, glass shower door." And they said, "Oh, don't think about it. That's opening up a can of peas." Just play the scene, so I did.
You know how earlier you were telling us that when you started working in music, when you started working with opera and art song, that you kept your Jimmy Olsen part of your life a secret because you thought it would hurt your credibility and people wouldn't want to work with you.
Yes.
How did you keep it a secret? Nobody recognized your name or your face?
Well, people did, but they didn't. People later told me they thought I was very foolish not to enjoy it more. But they could tell. I mean, I was really scarred. I see that now. And I would never do publicity. For instance, I was certainly later when I produced a film with Michael J. Fox. I was as popular as Michael and had it been now, I would have segued right into a major film. I mean, you can hardly, if you're popular in a television series, they want you to star in a film. That didn't exist then. You were the enemy if you were a television actor or star. And right away, it scared me in New York, as I said, when the show went on the air. And I never did any publicity. I would never pose for a picture. I would never do publicity. Magazines wanted to do articles on me. I wouldn't do it. And indeed, I never did publicity until when I said the Joffrey, this big explosion, a kind of scandal happened with the ballet, The Relativity of Icarus. And then when it all came out, and then I thought, oh, why not? Because people write about you anyway. They already were writing about me without me giving the interviews and getting things wrong. So I did it, and but you wouldn't find a picture of me for publication. I never posed for a picture in a bow tie. I wouldn't do it. And it made a very bad relationship, I can say, on their behalf. I understand their problem with this actor who they could have exploited.
Yeah. During the part of your life where you were keeping Jimmy Olsen a secret, did you make up a past or did you just not talk about the past?
No, I didn't talk about it. And all I can say is that apparently it was so apparent that I didn't want to talk about it, that people didn't talk to me about it. Like Frank O'Hara, Joe LeSueur, all the people. Later, they talked about it. I think it was John Ashbery who said to me that he always was amazed I didn't enjoy it more, you know. And I was aware that people would stare at me in restaurants or people would come up and it would embarrass me to sign autographs or things. But nobody would say anything. So, and I didn't have a wide, you know, really wide circle of friends like that. My closest friend during all those years was Montgomery Clift, really. And Monty was very reclusive. And so socially, often we go out to dinner and stuff. And but when you're forbidding like that, people don't bother you. And I was certainly forbidding. And as I said, when off time, I would grow a beard and do things. And I realized it was very neurotic behavior.
When George Reeves, who played Superman, committed suicide, did you understand it? Were you prepared for something like that?
I wasn't prepared for George to commit suicide. As a matter of fact, I was working in Germany at the time at a place called the Bavaria Filmkunst. I had gotten a gig there as an actor, and my next stop was Italy, and then come back to Los Angeles to do 26 more Superman. George was doing costume fittings at the time, and I knew I had to go to work again. But he, I knew he was depressed. He had the same problem I had. He couldn't get a job as an actor. And so I really wasn't surprised. And he'd had a long relationship with a, I thought, a wonderful woman who he split up with. They'd been together for 15 years, and I thought that might have depressed him. So I wasn't surprised. You know, I don't want to do something current affairs-y, you know, but a lot of people think he was murdered. His mother thought he was murdered. I believe Noel thinks that. A lot of people think that it was not a natural, wasn't a suicide. Hmm. And indeed, I saw with my own eyes three bullet holes in his bedroom. I was one of the first people to go into the house with the woman that inherited the house, Tony Mannix, who is the woman who lived with him all those years. And I saw three bullet holes. It only takes one to... I believe he committed suicide. If you're, since I've clouded the issue and all, I could understand that he'd committed suicide. And it was one of the things that made me quit acting. I thought, I'm not going to further depress myself fighting this thing of being typed. I've got other things to do. I can write.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I admire your show and you, and I'll be listening to Fresh Air as I do.
Jack Larson, speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. The former Jimmy Olsen has a small role in the new movie, Superman Returns. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Devil Wears Prada. This is Fresh Air. The new film The Devil Wears Prada stars Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestly, the fearsome editor-in-chief of a fashion monthly. It's based on Lauren Weisberger's novel about her own experience working at Vogue. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
I've always had a soft spot for gratuitously nasty revenge memoirs against Hollywood and media bosses, if only because there's no other way to shame these overweening big shots publicly. That's the guilty pleasure of reading Lauren Weisberger's, quote, novel, The Devil Wears Prada, the moralistic tale of a schlumpy young woman of integrity who somehow gets hired as an assistant to Anna Wintour at Vogue. I mean, her fictional stand-in, Miranda Priestly. Weisberger worked for Wintour and paints daily life at Vogue's counterpart, Runway, as a marathon of humiliations at the hands of a speed-freaky, narcissistic task mistress with zero capacity for empathy. David Frankel's movie of The Devil Wears Prada is less a revenge drama than a festival of clichés that panders shamelessly to its audience's Cinderella fantasies, which is why I think it's going to be a big hit. Its outline is vulgar, but it's gorgeously accessorized. The heroine, Andy, played by Anne Hathaway, wanders in for a job interview without knowing who Miranda Priestly is, or even having read the magazine. Grounds, I think, for regarding her as an idiot, a reverse snob, or both. But that's not the movie's view. No, she's just an innocent. It's the snobbish, slighting editor, played by Meryl Streep, who inspires fear and derision.
Who are you?
My name is Andy Sachs. I recently graduated from Northwestern University.
And what are you doing here?
Well, I think I could do a good job as your assistant. And, I came to New York to be a journalist and sent letters out everywhere and then finally got a call from Elias Clark and met with Sherry up at Human Resources. And basically it's this or Auto Universe.
So you don't read Runway?
No.
And before today, you had never heard of me?
No.
And you have no style or sense of fashion?
Well, I think that depends on what you're...
No. That wasn't a question.
That wasn't a question is a great line, and the movie does give the devil her due. Streep isn't playing Wintour. She looks and talks nothing like her, which is a problem because the lines are written for a Wintour-like dervish, too impatient even to wait for replies to her commands. Still, Streep gives a fabulous miniaturist performance. She's a measured, deliberate ogre, her hair brushed back, her anger signaled in the tiny tensing of a single facial muscle, her eviscerating dismissals fluted with an airy flick of her hand. She isn't a dummy. She understands not just couture, but the way designers' innovations trickle down even to the cheap clothing worn by Andy. In one scene, the movie lets us see the raw, unmade-up child under the Gorgon exterior, but it doesn't sentimentalize her. The problem is that The Devil Wears Prada is too gutless to make Andy truly tempted by the dark side. Sure, she gets dressed by Miranda's art director, played by Stanley Tucci, and proves she can look dishier in couture than anyone at her magazine. Sure, she trains herself to be a triumphant courtier. But despite the complaints that she's, quote, becoming one of them by her rumpled dreamboat sous chef boyfriend, played by Entourage's Adrian Grenier, the poor girl is hopelessly ethical and unmaterialistic. Just because she loves how she looks in these clothes and has to answer the phone at all hours to keep her job, she's morally compromised? If there's any drama here, it's slender, maybe a size 2. Hathaway does carry off the clothes. In fact, it's bizarre that all the characters regard her as an eyesore when her ivory complexion and huge eyes and long legs make her pure runway material, even in rags. But Hathaway overdoes the girlish wonderment, and she isn't up to her climactic to hell with the devil scene. She's acted off the screen by the young English actress Emily Blunt as Miranda's rival assistant. Blunt was a knockout in last year's My Summer of Love, and here she's a marvel at conveying the terror beneath the hauteur of the typical Miranda acolyte. The Devil Wears Prada trumpets the virtues of simplicity and integrity, But with its predictable Princess Diaries goes to Condé Nast template, its unearned moral superiority, its ubiquitous montages, and its ugly duckling heroine, who is neither ugly nor a duckling, it's an haute couture con. People who believe in simplicity and integrity don't make movies like this.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Audrey Bentham and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our radio engineering supervisor is Joyce Lieberman. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Letters from the Hive, An Intimate History of Bees, Honey, and Humankind by Stephen Buckman and Banning Replier. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Tommy Lee Jones, John C. Reilly, and Meryl Streep, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Wayne and Daryl Scott. Both father and son are country musicians and songwriters. Daryl's got a new album called The Invisible Man. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm famous to my friends and family, to my friends and